So, I've got a title for this talk, which comes, it's The Tender Gravity of Kindness. And it's a line from a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. And in it she says, before you know kindness as the deepest thing, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. So I wanted to just explore that area of the relationship between kindness or love and sorrow and depth and death. I suppose I'm just interested in that area. Because we tend to maybe transcendent just means to transcend just means to go beyond. So that word is used a lot in Buddhism, but often it has a sense of sort of upwards and forwards. Not always, but quite often. And I'm just personally interested in downwards and backwards. I mean, really, it's just a matter of perspective. I think Heraclitus said something like the way up and the way down are the same. I don't actually know why he said that or what he meant by that, but anyway. sometimes it's just interesting to look at something from a different angle. That's all. So, to start with, I wanted just to introduce a myth, because I like myths, which is one of going downwards, so a myth of descent, which is, in this case, I'm going to tell a story of Persephone's descent into the underworld. So, once upon a time, a long time ago, there were three brothers, three gods who ruled the world. Poseidon ruled the depths of the ocean, and Zeus ruled the land and the skies, and the third brother, Hades, ruled the underworld. And there are all sorts of other gods and goddesses as well. So a goddess, a powerful goddess of the land, is Demeter. So she's goddess of the crops, abundance, fruits, the earth. And she has a daughter. She has a daughter called Persephone, who's very beautiful. And her daughter plays every day in the meadows, the green flower-filled meadows under a blue sky with her friends. But one day, somehow, Hades, lord of the underworld, sees Persephone and he falls in love with her and he longs for her. But he knows that he can't have her because no one would agree to that match. He's held in too much fear. So he resolves to take her, not to ask, just to take. And one day when she's out of sight of her mother Demeter, she ventures alone and sees a beautiful flower, and as she's bending down to pick that flower, a crack opens up in the earth by her. And these huge shadowy shapes come out, four black horses, enormous, pulling this huge chariot with Hades in it. And he grabs her and pulls her back down into what is now this vast chasm. And although she screams, it makes no difference, and they plunge downwards into the depths of the earth until she can't see the daylight any longer. So far, far down into another realm. And when they enter Hades' kingdom, there are only the dead, the shades. This is where they live, or rather where they've died, where they spend their time. And she realizes, or she becomes, queen of this realm, queen of the underworld. She becomes Hades' queen. This is her realm. But all is not well with her mother. Her mother is both furious and deeply upset, deeply grieving for this disappearance of her daughter. She doesn't know where Persephone's gone. And she searches everywhere. And nobody says what's happened. She can't find anyone who says what happens. And in the end, she asks a goddess, also an underworld goddess, who said, "Well, I did hear a scream. I did hear a scream. You should ask Helios, the sun god. He sees everything." So she goes to Helios and said, "You know, did you see what happened to my daughter, Persephone?" And he says, "Oh, yes. Hades came and took her." So now she knows where Persephone is. And she's devastated. She has a long journey, which I won't go into the details of, but part of her devastation is that she stops doing what she's supposed to do, which is bringing the crops to ripening, allowing things to grow and flourish, abundance, ripeness, food. And as a consequence, all the people of this land, all the mortals, begin to starve. And the cries of despair rise up to the gods, even as high as Zeus, highest of the gods. And he realizes in the end he must do something. He has to respond. The situation is getting extreme. So he calls Hermes. Hermes is the messenger of the gods, the friendly god. And he's the only god who can go into the underworld. And Zeus asks Hermes, he says, "Will you go down to the underworld and bring Persephone back? She needs to come back." And Hades thinks about it and says, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." So he goes down, and when Hades sees Hermes approaching, he knows, okay, he'd hoped he could get away with it, but Persephone's obviously going to have to go back, so he doesn't fight that. He's okay to let Persephone go. And she returns with Hades to the land of light, to the land where she belongs, to the land of her mother. But when her mother sees her, she says, she just looks at her and thinks, "Oh, has she eaten anything? Has she eaten anything in the underworld?" She says, "Have you eaten anything? You didn't, did you? Say you didn't eat anything." And Persephone pauses, and at that point her mother realises that she has eaten something. And when you eat of the underworld, you can't leave. And Persephone had eaten some pomegranate seeds. It's unclear, like, did Hades give her those seeds? Did Hermes? Did she take them of her own free will? We don't know. But nonetheless, she did eat them. So she can't stay with her mother, and she can't stay with Hermes, with Hades. And in the end, an agreement is made where she must stay in the underworld for the number of months, same number of months as the number of pomegranate seeds she's eaten. So oftentimes it's said to be 4, maybe 5, sometimes 6 seeds. So during those months, she goes down to the underworld, and the land above dies and is barren. And then when she comes back up to Demeter, her mother, everything flourishes, the flowers blossom and the fruits ripen. So that's the story of Persephone and the underworld. So I've got, I'll just say a few things about myth. And then I just want to look at some motifs, but I fear I may have too many motifs to look at. So one description of what a myth is that it's a story about something that never was, but always is. Yeah. It never was, but it always is. So there's these recurring archetypal themes that we can resonate with. And myths are also stories about relationships. They're about all sorts of characters coming into relationship with each other. These characters, these gods, don't exist on their own. They're always in relationship. And all of their perspectives are valid. So any myth you can hear it from the point of view of Persephone or Demeter or Zeus or Hades or Hermes. They're all valid perspectives. And part of the reason why I'm interested in myths is that they're expressions of, well, the Western psyche, these Greek myths. So as Buddhists, we are trying to transform the whole of our psyches, but we don't have Eastern psyches, we have Western psyches. They work with different imagery. So I'm kind of interested in what the imagery, how that might work for us with Buddhist practice. So So the themes I'd like to talk about are to do with the surface and the depths, possession, descent, love, and paradox. So I'll crack on. So we've got this theme of surface and depth. Yeah. We have this world of Demeter, which is a world of light and sunshine. She's the goddess of harvests. She's the goddess of matter, of the material world, actually. And then we have this underworld, this world of darkness, death, depth as well. And there's a split between these two worlds, yeah? And there is a longing, the underworld is longing for the beauty up there. But the surface is not interested in any... Yeah, there's fear. There's fear in relation to the surface world down to the depths. Yeah, so the split is maintained by the upper world, you could say. So that might resonate a bit in terms of this split. You know, in a way, what sort of splits can we see perhaps in ourselves and maybe in our culture? I mean, our society has probably got this in quite obvious ways. Yeah, we have. A lot in our culture, society, that is superficial, yeah? This tendency to say just skin deep, superficial beauty, celebrity culture, gloss and spin, quick fixes, instant weight loss, fast food and speed dating. So I make a connection between speed and superficiality. You know, sometimes it's just, if you run fast enough, you can stay up on the surface like a cartoon character, yeah? So there's a sort of staying on the surface, which is to do with a running, as if we're scared of death, yeah? We stay on the surface. And I think it'd be fair enough to say we are a death-denying culture. And underneath this sort of surface gloss, you know, there's a lot of unhappiness, a lot of suffering as well. And interestingly, a lot of depression. This downward side. And it also, maybe the split is particularly true for the body, for us in relation to our bodies. Our bodies might stand for that in us which is less than shiny. They're invariably imperfect, full of animal desires, sometimes source of embarrassment or shame. They get sick, they need constant attention, feeding, watering, cleaning, toileting. We can experience them as limits, limitations too. And I think we can adopt a couple of different strategies with our body. One is to try and just ignore the body, stay up in the head space, and the other is to control the body. Yeah. So just treat it as an object, a tool. So there can be a sort of split there. I think our mind, I'm going to call it that, can have quite a critical, judgmental attitude to the body, and also be quite terrified about the weaknesses and perfections that are manifest in the body. Our sense of mortality that's so evident in our bodies. So I think there's a split there. And there's also another split which I think comes in terms of spiritual practice. There can that same judging or critical mind can come into our meditation, our spiritual practice, this desire to go upwards to the light, yeah, towards the happy, shiny states, in a way that avoids reality. a kind of wanting to jump over imperfections and weaknesses. So there's quite a lot of talk around this area, or has been comments around this. I mean, James Hillman back in 1975 even was talking about how Eastern religions, once they're uprooted and imported to the West, arrive, as he put it, debrided of its imaginal ground, dirt-free and smelling as sandalwood. Another upward vision offers a way to bypass our Western psychopathologies. So, I mean, Buddhism hadn't even hardly got started by then, so it's a bit, it's somewhat prescient there. And then later, you know, about 9 years later, John Wellwood coined the phrase spiritual bypassing, which you might be familiar with. So him saying that was as a Buddhist practitioner, who's also a therapist, and being a therapist to a lot of Buddhists, noticing. And he says, although most of us were sincerely trying to work on ourselves, I noticed a widespread tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. Yeah. So there's that sort of split that can happen as well. Yeah. And I think that might be a very familiar area to you, but to my mind anyway, I think it's worth reminding ourselves again and again, because I think in all sorts of subtle ways, it's just so compelling to be trying to do that. Yeah. Have a sense to try and go for this sort of premature transcendence above the raw messiness of our humanity. Yeah. And in a way, that's kind of why I'm interested in this sort of descent, this moving downwards, so it's which is a not avoiding. So the second theme I just wanted to look at is to do with possession and... this splitting off assumes that you can push and pull things, manipulate things, yeah, towards and away. And this grasping, you know, pulling towards or pushing away or resisting, it's the front and back of the same thing, yeah. It's the same mechanism, which arises from a particular view of the world. And that view is simply that things can be grasped and that we can grasp them, yeah? And the Yogacara talks about this, I mean, exactly those words. We've got grahaka, which is the grasper, you know, me, the grasper, and then grahya, that which is grasped. And there's this view that we can treat things as things, as objects, which we can then manipulate to our own ends by grasping or pushing away. And we can sort of see that a bit in this myth with both Demeter and Hades. In some ways, although there's love there, it's like they're both trying to possess Persephone. There's a bit of pushing and pulling going on there. Yeah. Again, this is something we can see in our culture, this view that we can grasp or possess things. And we believe it'll make us happy, so we believe it's possible, or at least the sort of culture, or at least what advertising sells us, is it's simply possible to grasp and possess things, and then happiness arises from that. But happiness isn't provided by possession of the material world, yeah? It's not something we can possess. And so you can say there's this mistaking of the material, of what matters, of the material realm of matter for what matters, yeah, for what gives meaning. And all spiritual traditions address this issue of what is meaningful in our lives. And you could say that as humans, maybe to know what matters and what has meaning is perhaps the most important thing. You know, if you understand, if you have a sense of meaning, it kind of makes everything worthwhile and bearable. And to quote Hillman again, he says, to make life matter or count or have a sense, the quality of depth needs to replace physical significance. And as he puts it, nothing matters more than death. Yeah. So you kind of get this sort of sense of meaning coming from depth and ultimately a willingness to turn towards death rather than from trying to grip things and keep you on the surface. Yeah. And again, it's completely possible to take this attitude of possessing into spiritual practice again. You know, you get spiritual materialism, you try and grasp hold of a really nice, exotic and fascinating states. You're just trying to appropriate that to your identity. Yeah. So there needs to be this needs to be a movement from this grasping and possessing to an opening and a letting go, yeah, which I'd say to my mind is like a movement of the heart, and it's an opening into love. And I think that because it's a sort of opening and a letting go, it can feel like a descent, yeah, that it can have that sort of quality to it. Which brings us to perhaps this main part of the myth, isn't it? This extraordinary image of Persephone being taken down into the depths. Dramatic. Yeah. So, what I find interesting is like that descent, although, you know, you've got one person, Persephone, who's perhaps shocked and traumatised and resisting. She's also getting pulled down because of love. I just find that quite interesting in a way. If there wasn't love and longing there, she wouldn't go down. There's something in that I find rather fascinating. And I suppose for me there's something about the practices of love, the practices of metta and the Brahmaviharas allow that sort of descent. Yeah, and I think we can think of different sorts of descent again. There's a descent in relation to the body, so from the head into the body. Which is one of like learning. It's so important that we learn how to ground our ideals into our being, into our experience, into our bodies. So there's this embodiment that's so important, which feels like a moving downwards in Buddhism, as well as just simply as coming into relationship with the body that does express how things are. In other words, it is really obviously it just ages, doesn't it, and fails in various ways. There's such a teaching there if you're willing to face that. But there's also a sort of moving down, I think, in relation to the world or to other. Yeah. So just thinking, which is around the area of empathy. Ian McGilchrist has got a great book out called The Master and His Emissary, which some of you here might have. It's a fantastic book. I would recommend it. And he's making a point about empathy and saying it's the ability, which is the ability to resonate or feel connected with others. And he's saying it's intrinsically tied up with the imagination, but also with sorrow. Yeah. So he says the more we are aware of and empathically connected to whatever it is that exists apart from ourselves, the more we're likely to suffer. Sadness and empathy are highly correlated, and perhaps to feel at all is inevitably to suffer. So then he makes this connection, the Greek word pathē, which is feeling, is related to pathos, or affliction, and to the German pashin, to suffer. Then the same root is in passion. Yeah. So there's this connection here, there. And he's saying it's just one reason to doubt the rather easy equation that we make between pleasure and happiness on the one hand and the good on the other. And he also says that he suggests, well, empathy is intrinsic to morality. So we got this sense of empathy as this dynamic, sensitive relationship, this betweenness of beings, of sentience, of awareness, that allows us to be moved by, to resonate with the world, which means that we must be open to experiencing sorrow as well as joy, and we must be open to turning towards death as well as birth and life. Yeah. Buddhism is essentially a relational practice. Yeah. And going for refuge, you could see, as a devotional act which involves relating to others. So all of that, for me again, is this sort of movement downwards. And then we've got something, actually I noticed on the poster by the door, these five aspects of spiritual practice. Here we've got spiritual death as well, which is a descent. Sometimes. So this is another spiritual death, another metaphor, isn't it? Perhaps we could say it's when the assumptions and the views that we've held to cease to work or function. We have a sense the carpet gets pulled out from under us. Things fall apart in a sense of the way the map stops working. Doesn't make any sense. Yeah, we don't know. We don't really know what's happening any longer. Yeah, and actually this is a very important state to arrive in, because actually we don't know. The trouble is we think we do know. It's quite good to get to a place where you realise you don't know. But when you don't know anymore, when the psyche, in the face of not knowing, the psyche can't imagine anything other than death and dying. Yeah, so you get this image of spiritual death. And crucially important times in our lives, and it's important, it's what allows something new to come in, but it requires this letting go again, letting go of surety and security. Again, this what we were grasping onto and trying to possess, we open and let go of. And maybe move more into a state of mystery and perhaps beauty and awe as well. So all those are aspects of descending, ways we might imagine descending. Moving from ideas to embodiment. Moving from this grasping and possessing way, utilitarian way of dealing with the world, to resonance of empathy. And also moving from the fixity of views and certainties to something more fluid and mysterious. And I think the quality that brings this about is love. Yeah, we could say love is a turning towards, a willingness to meet and engage with and be intimate with things and people and experiences, yeah, with the world. It's a movement down towards what we might normally avoid due to fear or shame or whatever. Yeah. It requires an act of love, that. And like Persephone, we might find that when we do descend, we come into our kingdom, we find our realm. It's quite interesting, isn't it, to descend and discover your realm, that you're queen in your realm. This realm, Hades' realm, is associated with riches. So he's also, well, the Romans called him Pluto, where he was the god of wealth and abundance. Yeah, both. You know, partly obviously mineral wealth is found below ground, and also the deep earth was seen as containing all the seeds necessary for a bountiful harvest. So there's a sense of richnesses that lie below, wealth that lies below, perhaps in the shadows, in the depths. So I'm doing pretty well for time, that's good. I want to just talk a bit about metta in relation to all this, having got onto the importance of love in terms of allowing us to move downwards. I think the qualities of metta suggest to us, in a way, what it takes to have that movement down towards depth. So firstly, it's unconditional. Yeah, metta, kindness, love is unconditional. It demands nothing in return. So you just love. There's no reason to love. There need be no reason. You just love because that is the heart's response to what is, to the way things are. So there is nothing utilitarian in metta at all. It's not about getting anything. It's a boundless state also, so it excludes nothing. It's non-judgmental. Nothing falls outside of love. Nothing is too bad or dark or disruptive. And ultimately, it's not separate from wisdom. Or we could say that it is the way that wisdom expresses itself through the heart. Or we could say that wisdom is the way the heart of love sees the world. So there's the heart of love would be a responsiveness to everything that's arising in the world at this moment, which includes joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain, with this intuitive understanding that all of this is dependently arising. Yeah, everything is arising in dependence on conditions. This intuitive understanding that this me can't ever be separated from the world. Yeah, I don't exist separately. I can't exist separately. I only ever exist in context. Yeah, in a way, I could say I am what I am because you are what you are right now. And this place is what it is, which all requires the whole world. So how I am right now is because of how the world is right now. And yet what I am and what the world is unpindownable, completely transient. Each moment is fleeting, and there's not even such a thing as a moment. That itself is an idea. Yeah. So everything right now has arisen in dependence on conditions, on what has gone before. So here in this room, we have the entire world and all things that have ever happened before throughout time. Yeah, and none of us is separate from that. So you get this vastness. Yeah, and I think this is how the heart of love, the liberated heart, sees the world. Yeah, so this is a sort of wisdom element. You get this upekkha, equanimity, where it sees the whole picture. Sees and is moved by the whole picture. So I just want to say something about working with the heart. That's the heart at its most liberated, I've tried to evoke. So just working with the heart. So firstly, we're not talking about the anatomical heart, yeah? We're talking about the heart as centre of love. So we're talking already about an image or a metaphor. Let's say the heart is essentially poetic, yeah? It responds poetically to the world. And the metta bhavana is an imaginative practice, maybe essentially too, a poetic practice. Yeah. And it is, as I've already said, it's a context where we turn towards, where we are willing to be intimate with our experience, where we notice not what we'd like to be, but what we actually are, or where we actually are. Yeah. So it does mean turning towards that in us which is both loving and that in us which isn't loving. Yeah. And as we begin to work with the heart, we start to get a sort of uncovering of what gets locked up of the things that we have been pushing away. So, you know, maybe you've had this if you've kind of gone on a longer retreat or done more metta bhavana. You know, you can get, I think it can involve quite a lot of grief actually sometimes. a lot of grief can come up, sort of unprocessed loss, things that we have experiences we just haven't known what to do with, and we just, you know, push them down. So there's this stirring up of grief, and also of remorse as well. Yeah, you remember that awful thing that you did that you really wish you hadn't, but then you have been trying to forget. Yeah, I remember being on a metta retreat quite a long time ago, and just there's a certain point where it felt like everybody was in tears, sort of for the same reason. Yeah, this sort of sense of everybody was remembering the awful things they'd, you know, been trying so hard to forget, and just having to come to terms with what that, you know, how it is to live with that, and not hate yourself for it, because that's pretty counterproductive. So there's also something about the metta bhavana that it does, I think it does provoke the darker sides of ourselves. You know, I mean, the stages are sort of, in a way, they are a bit pokey, aren't they? You know, you might start with something easy. Well, actually, people don't necessarily even find the first stage easy, but you start bringing the difficult people in, and there's a provocativeness to the practice. So actually, it's not a bad thing. It's not like you're doing it wrong when you start, those darker things start coming up. I think, well, great, the practice is working. That's, you know, that's all there that can be transformed, rather than stuff being locked away. And I think working with the practice also, over time, you start to see the way that your particular, if you want to call them, emotional wounds and beliefs have a power to influence and shape and distort the way that you practice and the way you view the spiritual path. It's usually quite unconscious, these things, but it's only as you keep practicing you notice sort of familiar unhelpful patterns you keep going around, and then you realise there's a view underneath that. Yeah. I mean, I think culturally it does seem like Eastern cultures just don't really suffer. Kind of gorgeously, don't seem to suffer from self-loathing and low self-esteem, whereas we seem to manage to do that really well. So there's something about needing to learn how to work, how to cultivate love when that keeps tripping you up. Yeah. So for me, just to give an example. Actually, yeah, pranayama sort of, I did do the metta bhavana every day for a few years, but I haven't, it's not like I've been doing it recently. Anyway, just this made it sound like every day I do it. Not true. but for me, I did have this period when I was doing the metta every day, because I really saw that actually I would be miserable for the rest of my life unless I figured out how to how to love. It was just became really obvious to me, so that was motivation enough. But I found it incredibly hard. I was really resistant to it, and so one day I sat myself down and I sort of ended up having this conversation, which was sort of along the lines of, you know, logically I could see I'm doing a practice that's all about love and kindness. How can that possibly be anything other than lovely? Yeah, if you think about it, it makes no sense that it's difficult. Makes no sense at all, and yet there was I really resisting it. So I was having this little conversation with myself about this, and then what I got was this little voice piping up saying, "When will I ever be good enough? When will I ever be good enough?" And I kind of realised, oh, that's what the problem is. You see, no matter which way I come at the metta bhavana, a little bit of me is always interpreting it as a judgment that it's not all right. Yeah. It's really helpful to see that. You then have to figure out what to do with it. But and in a way, that is one of the issues, isn't it, that's raised with the metta bhavana, is like, how can you come into a loving relationship with yourself? How do you do that? I mean, that's the sort of precursor for coming into a loving relationship with others. So what is it to be kind to yourself, just as you are, whilst at the same time knowing that you have this vast potential that also requires an unfolding? Yeah, it would be to wrong yourself to not unfold and become what you could be, but also you don't want to somehow have that being a message that you're not good enough as you are. Yeah, so anyway, it's a little one to sort of go round it again and again, I suppose, until you figure that one out. So I think, in a way, paradoxically, we must already love something to make us want to look at what limits our heart. So in a way, you sort of need love to, in a way, cultivate love. That makes sense. I think metta is a rite of fascination. There must be, there's a love which compels you to keep going with this work. So it's a bit like this image of Persephone and Hades. It's like there's a duplicity of sort of both love and fear. Yeah, there's a resistance and a pulling away, and there's also a pulling downwards. And we might have that sort of feeling going on a bit with metta. And I also think, in terms of this, in terms of practicing metta, we do need to be able, do need to be prepared to fail, in the sense of, like, you can never love enough. Yeah. You can never love enough. There's no end point to get to. You know, and I mean, I just know from my experience of living in community for years, it's like, you know, just again, you've blown it. you kind of lost it. You're doing so, I was doing so well, and then I lost it again. And it's just, you know, in a way, that just needs to be okay, actually. You need to be fine with failing. It's just a slow process working with the heart. The heart cannot be forced. It doesn't change through willing it to change. It doesn't change because of ideas or force. Yeah, I don't think it even particularly responds to the heroic, or mine doesn't. Yeah, it requires just a lot of slow, steady patience. Yeah, forbearance. So, we'll come on to the last bit, which is around paradox. So we got this very curious resolution to this myth, which is some sort of strange, seems like some strange compromise. But anyway, just a few thoughts around it. By the end, both Hades and Demeter sort of moved from this sort of fight over possession, almost, you could say. You could say, to one of empathy, yeah? Hades knows that he needs to let Persephone go, yeah? He understands that too much suffering is being caused. And Demeter also understands that she can't have Persephone, because she sees that Persephone has been nourished by the underworld, yeah? So there's a sort of understanding starts to come into this, into the picture a bit. So different worlds start to understand each other. And then there's also Hermes. I think he's my favourite god. Hermes. So he's the messenger of the gods, he's the friendliest of the gods, he's the traveller, he's the god of merchants and thieves. Yeah. He's the only god who can go into the underworld. So he has this quality, yeah, he's this archetype which has the quality of being able to pass between worlds. Yeah. He can steal across borders and boundaries, he can take things from one world to another, he's a translator. As well as the merchant and a thief, yeah. And there's something about him as an archetype which is allowing movement and communication between the worlds, yeah, and allowing riches to pass backwards and forwards from the depths to the heights, from the darkness into the light, yeah. It's as if the very movement that he allows between the worlds is enriching, yeah, gives that value, yeah. So we sort of end up with this sense of Persephone becomes doubly abundant in a certain sort of way, yeah? She's ends up as a queen of her realm and nourished by that realm, but also still part of the blossoming and the fruit and the light of this other world. She's got both. And she also ends up doubly beloved, yeah, both of Demeter and Hades. So There's something for me about, we get this a lot, don't we, in Buddhism, this sort of the tension or the paradox that the Bodhisattva holds, you know, or that we hold between inner and outer, between self and world, yeah, and maybe between our own heights and depths. There's something for me there about the creativity of that tension, yeah, and the constant, it doesn't resolve itself, but more, there's something that we learn or something that we can bring out in us that allows the movement, that allows the riches to move between worlds, yeah, inner and outer, and in heights and depths. And maybe something about those riches, which in a way are both a sort of a fuel for and also an expression of awakening.